From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. June 28th marks the beginning of the month-long observance of Ramadan in the Islamic faith, and on the 29th, Christians celebrate the feast of Saints Peter and Paul. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief.
Idaho is really more the front lines. You know, you're in a red state trying to work on what have formerly been known as blue issues.
Jody Mae Chang is an independent journalist living in Boise, Idaho. Her reporting from the front lines of the culture wars is both challenging and inspiring. And she'll be with us to talk about doing that kind of work from America's Rocky Mountain West later on this week's show.
When Prop 8 won by a razor-thin margin, protesters saw Mormon donations as the deciding factor.
After bringing anger and controversy on itself thanks to aggressive activism and spending in support of California's Proposition 8, the Mormon Church has made headlines in recent years with definite efforts at moderation and inclusivity. The 2012 Gay Pride Parade in Salt Lake City, Utah, featured 300 heterosexual LDS members marching under the banner of Mormons Building Bridges. And so for a while, it appeared that there was some progress being made. But with the news earlier this month that two prominent Mormon activists were being threatened with excommunication for apostasy, some very serious questions need to be asked about the direction the denomination is taking. On this week's show, I'll talk to author and activist Carol Lynn Pearson, whose very personal experiences with the church's stance on homosexuality led to her writing such books as Goodbye, I Love You, The Story of a Wife, Her Homosexual Husband, and A Love Honored for Time and All Eternity. But first,
controversy inside the Mormon Church. Officials threatening to expel two activists, one who's pushing for women priests, the other targeted for questioning church doctrine.
Bruce Bastian grew up in the Mormon Church as an active participant in the church. The church sent him to Italy, and he went. The church said, get married, and he did. A graduate of Brigham Young University, Bruce responded to losing a job in music by pursuing software development, and he wound up co-founding the Word Perfect Corporation. Today, Bruce is a respected philanthropist with a passion for fostering inclusion and equality as head of the B.W. Bastian Foundation. Bruce is also openly gay and estranged from the church that so harshly constrained his identity for so many years. As we watch what happens to be a hard turn to the right for the Mormon Church, I'm very pleased to be able to welcome Bruce Bastian to State of Belief Radio. Bruce, welcome.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
I think it might be good if we have you begin talking just a little bit about your relationship with the LDS Church.
Well, you were correct in your intro that I did grow up in a Mormon family, and I was an active member. I went to BYU. I went on a mission to Italy. It was kind of an expected thing then, and it's even more so now. Mm-hmm. I was told when I was 25 and single that if you're 25 and single, you are a burden to society. So I felt a lot of pressure to get married, and I did. Mm-hmm. I even told at least one leader of the church that I had gay tendencies, and he said I should get married and I would learn to love my wife. So I did. Mm-hmm. That lasted until my mid-30s, at which time I was even a member of the bishopric, and I don't know if your listeners understand what a bishopric is. A bishopric is in charge of a local ward or charge of a local parish or congregation, and they're all lay people. No one in the Mormon Church is paid to function as a priest or a head of a congregation, but I was one of the leaders of the congregation. So I went from that down as far as you can go, and did become very much estranged from the church. I have no affiliation with the Mormon Church now.
You know, I thought actually some time back that there was a glimpse of progress in the church's relationship with voices of dissent. Did you have that hope, or was I just missing it?
After their involvement with Proposition 8 in California, and after Prop 8 passed, there was a huge backlash in California and in Utah, not only from the LGBT community, but just friends of that community and other people who were appalled at how much money and effort the LDS Church gave in getting that passed. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge PR debacle for them. Mm-hmm. They suffered in new membership, and their tithing receipts went down, and that's what really hurt them.
Yeah. There are two activists right now being threatened with excommunication, and both of these people have tried to balance a commitment to the church with a commitment to their own consciences. Kate Kelly is a human rights lawyer who works for women's rights in the Mormon Church, including ordination. Do you know Kate?
I do not know Kate. I know John DeLynn. I'm not really familiar with his case, but I know John is still an active member of the LDS Church. He still wants to guide the church into the damage that some of their practices cause, especially to younger LGBT individuals. That's been the thrust of his doctoral research. Mm-hmm. Basically discovered with a lot of evidence that if the church just comes out with love and support, they don't have to have full acceptance or whatever, but if they just leave off the damnation and the be straight or we'll throw you out verbiage, if they just leave that little part out, the suicide rate plummets. Mm-hmm. And the ability for family and friends to kind of wrap around this individual and help him or her through this teenage crisis, it really helps. And because he's been so, in their opinion, pro-gay, they're threatening excommunication.
Mm. On State of Belief Radio, we've talked a lot about the methodical way that conservative, Protestant, and Catholic groups have banded together fundamentally to redefine religious liberty in this country, and then to use that definition to defy the government, oppose marriage equality, and endorse discrimination. Is that the kind of political calculus that you see happening or has happened in the Mormon Church as well?
Very much so. Some of the high leadership of the Mormon Church, especially Dallin Oaks, who's an apostle, which is one of the 12 big leaders of the mm-hmm. church, he has been preaching about religious freedom ideas for several years. And if you really go to the depths of and really look into this, it's a lot of Mormon money that's been funding lawyers and other activists on this whole issue. They have been reluctant. They don't want to get their name out there as one of the big pushers of this idea, but they are.
Right.
A lot of the lawyers have direct affiliation with the Mormon Church, and a lot of the documents and so-called evidence of the religious liberties argument comes directly from Salt Lake City.
You know, that's what just frustrates the daylights out of me, as well as makes me angry, because I have some people that I talk with in the Mormon Church, and they are forever talking about what staunch supporters of religious freedom they are, but it's religious freedom by their definition.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I understand how a church as an entity, like a congregation or whatever, does not want to be forced to perform gay weddings. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I understand how a church as an employer doesn't want to have to include certain things in their employee base. I understand that. But for them to be fighting for a local plumber to not have to fix someone's leaky pipes because he rings the bell and it's obviously two lesbians that answer, then for him to write to say, no, I don't support your lifestyle and walk away, that's not religious liberty. That's just discrimination.
Yeah, and at the same time, they are expecting that plumber to comply with what they say should be done, but not listening at all to what he wants to do. And that, you're right, that is not religious freedom. I'm curious, is religious freedom a doctrine in the church, or is this whole talk about religious freedom on the part of the hierarchy just a matter of church politics?
It's not. If you were to go, it's been years since I went to a church meeting, but if you went to a church meeting, I don't know if you would hear a lot said about religious freedom. Uh-huh. You might in the general conference. It certainly is something that they have been talking to certain people, politicians. If the bills that are, there have been bills introduced in Congress, and those have been written by LDS mm-hmm. members who are congressmen. So it is an issue that's on their front burner. Mm-hmm. It is an issue that they are paying a lot of attention and spending a lot of money on. I don't know how many general members of the church know everything that's going on. I suspect few.
Yes.
But it is something that's really important to them.
Bruce, do you see a new wave of policies coming from the church?
That's hard to say. There has been a change in some of the public relations personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a group of us in Utah that has tried to work closely with some of the people since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the last 12 months, it seems that they've taken a hard corner to the right, a hard turn to the right.
Yeah.
So it baffles me. We were encouraged for a long time. They kind of, in a very quiet way, stood up and agreed with the non-discrimination ordinance that Salt Lake City passed.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the state wanted to do the same thing last year, the church said, well, we have to have a very strong religious liberties amendment mm-hmm. into that, which was basically said, nobody has to really adhere to this if they have any personal objections with it based on religious liberty. So it didn't pass, of course.
2 or 3 years ago, I went out to Salt Lake City. I had written a piece on religious freedom and same-gender marriage, and I went out to talk with a group of LDS people about that, and the group was mostly GLBTQ community. And I just tell you, Bruce, I was stunned in the discussion session. The people were weeping, and what they said was they had never heard a religious leader affirm their sexual orientation and offer them encouragement about being able to marry the people they love.
I totally believe that. A lot of people in Utah live in a bubble. And the only religious teachings they hear or preaching or talk at all is from the LDS Church.
Yeah.
So I very much believe that having the opportunity to hear a religious person such as yourself speak of love and acceptance on this issue mm-hmm. would be very emotional for these people.
The most persistent question was, should we stay in the church? And that's not a question I could easily respond to, because different people have different needs there. If someone asks you that, what do you say to people like that?
Well, I say that I cannot answer that for you.
Right.
However, I know there are churches, an increasing number of churches, even in Utah, where you can go to church and you can feel the religious and have the religious input that you need and still feel welcome and accepted for who you are.
Mm-hmm.
If you are determined to stay in the Mormon Church. Mm-hmm. I would not expect the Mormon Church to change its dogma on this anytime soon, if ever. I would say, so you're going to have to ask yourself, do you want to live a full and happy life, or do you want to be a Mormon and be as happy as they will allow you to be?
I think that's a very, very fair way to do it. What is the most important thing that people of faith and of no faith need to know about the LDS Church and its role in our secular culture today and going forward?
I think people in and out of the LDS Church need to understand that they spend time, they spend money in trying to influence politics and the society in general, not just within the LDS Church, but in general. They are much more involved in this than most people understand. I'm not an active Mormon, but I have had many meetings with people who were pretty high up in the LDS Church and very much involved in their public relations department. So I do know what they do and the involvements that they are in. And it's a lot more than people think.
Yeah.
So I would just say, you know, ask questions. Really, don't just take what you hear on the news or read in a blog. Really ask questions.
One of the things that I know has always been a strong, pervasive theme in that church is families and the solidarity and stability of families. And yet, your experience makes me feel like that if there is a conflict in the family that needs to be addressed and you don't address it the way that the church says address it, you're in trouble with the church.
They speak almost as if they are afraid that you may take the side of the family member that's against the church. And so they actually said from the pulpit, and I have heard these, they are televised all over Utah, people in high leadership positions basically say if there's a conflict between what the church is telling you and what a family member is telling you or doing, you should stay with the church, even if it means that you have to stop your association with this family member, whether it's a parent or a child even. It gets really harsh, and they say that the most important thing to them is family. But when they do things like this, it really makes me question.
Yeah, I can see why. I have one last question, and on this one, I'm going to have to give you a time constraint for two reasons. One is because I'm already over and the producer's telling me that. The second is that I think you could probably talk for a week about answering this question. If you had a chance, a minute or a minute and a half to speak to the hierarchy of the church, what would you say to them?
Well, I have, and I'll tell you what I've told them. I didn't speak directly to them, but I did speak to someone who relayed the message, and I would say, I respect the right of anyone to believe and practice any religious beliefs that they choose. I respect the Mormon Church to be able to preach whatever they want. What I do not respect is their right, and I do not accept their right to interfere with my legal rights, with my rights as an American citizen, with my rights as a taxpayer. And I wish they would, you know, say what they want to say to a point and then leave me alone. Leave me alone to enjoy my life and have the rights and privileges that the Constitution of the United States entitles me to have.
Well, I don't often say amen, but I would say amen. Bruce Bastian is a human rights activist and philanthropist, raised in the Mormon Church. He co-founded Word Perfect Corporation and today works to support initiatives for inclusion, acceptance, and the arts through the B.W. Bastian Foundation. Bruce, I know there are not the happiest things to be talking about that we've talked about today, but they are things we must talk about because people simply have to know the truth about what's going on and have to learn that same-gender marriage is not about being a good Mormon. It's about being a good American. It's not about your faith. It is about your patriotism. All of the people in our country have rights, including the Mormon Church, but so do you.
And I will say amen to that.
Okay.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to speak with you and your listeners.
Now an update. Since this interview was recorded, the LDS Church acted on June 23rd to formally excommunicate Kate Kelly. National news stories suggest John Dalen is worried he could face the same action next week. And a public Mormon dissident on the ultra-conservative side of criticizing the church, Rock Waterman, has also been threatened with excommunication, according to a June 19th New York Times article that cites more than 12 Mormons who have recently been threatened with excommunication in connection with public dissent.
Carol Lynn Pearson is a practicing Mormon, an author, and an activist. She's a poet, a playwright, and a screenwriter, and she's also someone who knows firsthand what the harsh policies of the LDS Church can do to human lives. As we consider whether a new swing toward a conservative stance is being demonstrated by the recent threat to excommunicate two dissident activists, I'm very happy to have Carol Lynn Pearson join us on State of Belief Radio. Carol Lynn, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here, Wilton.
You shared your story in a remarkable book titled Goodbye, I Love You, The Story of a Wife, Her Homosexual Husband, and a Love Honored for Time and All Eternity. Talk briefly about what the church recommended.
Sure. In 1966, I was married to my husband, Gerald Pearson, in the Salt Lake Temple, and he had already told me during our engagement that he had had homosexual inclinations and some experience, but that's not who he was, and he was a very devoted member of the Mormon Church, and he did love me to the absolute best that he could. I did not ever go for counseling to the church to say, what should I do about this? I felt very comfortable in moving ahead with the marriage. Gerald had talked to a variety of leaders in the church about his sort of repentance process. And there was, at that time, a pretty clear understanding, well, because we were all very dumb back in the 60s, that this was something you just repented from. And you find a good woman and you move forward. And I have many friends that I have talked to who were indeed counseled to just repent and read the scriptures and pray. And if you are devoted to your marriage, all will be well. Mm-hmm. So we went ahead with our marriage. And in so many ways, it was a good marriage. Gerald learned soon that what he had hoped for had not happened, that his primary need was and always would be for a man. Mm-hmm. But he did not want to leave us. And we had four children. And then when we both realized that things were not as we had planned, we had another actually 4 years, two in Utah and then two as we moved to Northern California to try to figure out how to save the marriage. Eventually, we did end the marriage and remain good friends. He went to find his life, hoping to find a true love. And 6 years later, he passed away from AIDS. And that was in my home here in Walnut Creek, where I was caring for him at the time. And I never thought I would write our story. And he and I never discussed it, but it seemed to me soon after his death that if I could write our story, it would be a good contribution to a lot of people, especially to our Mormon community. And I had already become a recognized author. Gerald had insisted on that. He published my first book of poetry, which strangely was quite a phenomenal success. So I did write that book, and it was, as I had hoped, a large opening in the Mormon community to talk about this subject in a way that had not been discussed before.
Carol Lynn, how in the world did you manage to get through that harrowing experience?
Well, just day by day, and it was not easy, and there were a lot of tears and a lot of anger and a lot of absolute dismay. My world was on the floor in little pieces, and I had to pick up each piece and say, does this still fit? What can I build now? I have always had a very good, wide set of friends, and family. And my work was always, always important to me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't ever go to the local church here for help me figure out what to do, because I felt that I knew what to do. Mm-hmm. But at the end, well, when I had my former husband here in the house, the local ward, as we call it, just stepped up to the plate and did remarkable support for me during that last period of time when Gerald was here dying.
How were you able then to stay in the church?
I really have always felt a very strong calling that this is my place. This is where I was planted. And I believe that we're to bloom where we are planted, if it is a good place for that. Mm-hmm. Now, I know a lot of people for whom Mormondom is not a good place to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never suggest that anybody stay who does not feel that they can really grow there. But, see, the Mormon community is a very complex phenomenon. And I have my list of really positive things that make up that community, mm-hmm. that draw me to stay, as well as the knowledge that I have the capacity that where I do not find love in this community, and my only really complete picture of God is that God is love.
Mm-hmm.
And so wherever you find love, there you find God. And actually, I do find a lot of love in the Mormon community, and therefore a lot of God. And I know that as I can experience the love that is there, it's a valuable thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
And then having the opportunity that I do as a writer and to be placed with some very interesting issues, I have the opportunity to create more love where I see that love is lacking.
Mm.
And I'm just supposed to be here.
How far do you think the LDS Church has moved today from offering the kinds of solutions offered to your former husband?
It is specifically said that we do not encourage marriage as a cure for homosexual inclination,
mm-hmm.
or as the term generally is, same-sex inclination.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is still a significant pressure on young LDS gay men especially, that if you find that you have pretty much overcome those inclinations and feel that you could be attracted to the woman of your choice, that this would be a good step for you.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of, well, more than a couple of pretty highly visible public gay men who are married to women,
mm-hmm.
both of whom are therapists, and don't necessarily say this is the way that everyone should go, but just having that image there makes a lot of families think, well, see, you can do it too. You can do it. You know, just gird up your loins and pray a lot, and you too can enter marriage and have those blessings.
Hmm.
So it is still a very complicated situation here.
Now, I want to ask you about the threats to excommunicate two prominent activists from the church. Is that a change in the way the church has been dealing with dissent since Prop 8?
Well, since Prop 8, this would be the first visible kind of action taken against
mm-hmm.
anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, maybe every other decade or so, there have been several. Well, the famous one about 20 years ago was when there were 6 excommunications of intellectuals and feminists.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us thought that that was just not going to happen again. And I don't know that that is what is happening right now. It's difficult to really judge.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sad thing. I'm just kind of watching to see how it's going to play out.
Right.
Much of this does depend on the locale of the person
mm-hmm.
who's kind of making the waves. I have been quite protected here in Northern California. And as you said in my introduction, I know firsthand about the punishment. I have personally not been punished for anything that I have
mm-hmm.
done. I know that I am watched by those in authority, but I've had a lot of good appreciation come to me. There are several fairly clear issues here I have never created an organization whose intent is to put pressure on the church for something, although I have put out some significant, challenging ideas. Maybe the most challenging doesn't even have to do with my work for gay people,
mm-hmm.
but I came to the earth of fire with women's issues,
mm-hmm.
and my largest contribution there to this point has been a one-woman play that I wrote and performed over 300 times called Mother Will of the Morning that has 16 women throughout history in search of God, the mother. So that has been a particular mm-hmm. issue that I have dealt with and been very, very public about. I did not ever do anything specifically against the Mormon Church in that. That mm-hmm. was a very general thing, but nevertheless kind of a scary thing for any part of the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that my local leadership appreciated that play very, very much, and mm-hmm. I have reason to believe may have kind of protected me if questions came from mm-hmm. Salt Lake City.
Carolyn, tell me one of your favorite stories about your activism and the difference it's made in somebody's life.
Oh, well, you know, a writer has such an awesome opportunity to have their words go out and be taken into the hearts and minds of somebody who reads the book and who is, in this case, voracious
mm-hmm.
for some kind of validation, for some kind of warmth. And I've had thousands of people respond to my work and tell me that they had been contemplating suicide and now they feel different. Now, you don't get much better payday than that.
That's true.
In this world. And families have contacted me and said because of the kinds of things that I have given in my writing, that their whole attitude have changed. And I have that from bishops and state presidents as well, and from people higher on the authority list as well. So I know that the kinds of things that I have done has made a change in the thinking of very large numbers of the members in my church.
How can people find your book to read it?
Goodbye, I Love You.
Yes.
Could be ordered from Amazon. You could get a signed copy from my website. Anybody who wants to know more about me, just go to clpearson.com.
Okay.
And can get my books there. A subsequent book called No More Goodbyes tells many recent stories of sad goodbyes that we continue to say of suicide, ill-fated marriages, family alienation that has been useful for a lot of people.
Carolyn Pearson is an author, poet, playwright, screenwriter. Her books include Goodbye, I Love You, The Story of a Wife, Her Homosexual Husband, and a Love Honored for Time and All Eternity, and more recently, No More Goodbyes, Circling the Wagons Around Our Gay Loved Ones. Carolyn, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I so enjoyed being with you.
On a visit to Idaho a few years back, I had the pleasure of sitting down for an interview conducted by independent journalist and activist Jody May Chang. On my return to Boise, I am pleased to have the opportunity to return the favor. Jody is joining me here at Radio Boise Studios, and my challenge is to be sure that I keep asking the questions, not her, this time. Jody, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend. Thanks for asking me.
You grew up in Southern California. Now you've been in Idaho for, I think, about 15 years.
Yes.
How big a change was that for you, doing the work that you do?
I've always said that Idaho is really more the front lines. I mean, this is where really the work needs to happen because, you know, you're in a red state trying to work on what have formerly been known as blue issues, although I think the tide of that is changing. So it was a culture shock. Let's put it that way. I had a 10-year-old son when I first moved here who's now 25, and it was a great place to raise him. It was a lot safer, but very, very conservative. The first time that we came to Idaho, we found billboards protesting the documentary It's Elementary on PBS, that was a little jarring to have to explain that to my 10-year-old at the time.
Did you know what you were coming to?
Yes and no. I mean, I knew that there was a thriving gay community here, and I knew that there was a lot of work to be done. I had met a few people before I had decided to move here. But at the same time, until you actually get into the cultural climate, you can only project what you think it might be like. It was very different. I came from California. When I first moved here, it was illegal for my wife and I to have sex in this state. So
goodness. Well, I know from your questioning of me that one of your interests has been the interreligious movement. With Pam Baldwin, I'm curious about some of the things that you have found in the Interfaith Alliance work with which you identify and that you've tried to cooperate on.
Well, Pam was – she's going to be a hard act to follow.
Right.
We all miss her so much. She had such a vibrancy and a stalwartness for her causes that her and I were kind of kindred spirits around the book The Family, mm-hmm. That Jeff Charlotte wrote, and some of my work in Uganda. And I found the Interfaith Alliance really opened me up to being – more open to people of different faiths and faith traditions, because being raised as a Jew and a lesbian, my experience with Christianity has always been rather negative. Mm-hmm. I've since met some really wonderful, beautiful people of faith who are what have restored my faith in humanity and people of faith. Mm. And Pam was really instrumental in that, and her work with the Interfaith Alliance, and then supporting LGBT issues and other social justice issues throughout the state just really opened my eyes that, wow, you know, there can be people who are very deeply religious or have a very deep faith who believe in social witness as it right. originally, I think, was intended.
Yeah. Well, you've already mentioned a topic that I want to talk about while we're together, and that's Uganda. Mm-hmm. You've been doing some very specific work in relation to that tragic situation for the LGBT community in Uganda. Mm-hmm. Talk about what you're doing there and how all of this relates to everything else that's going on in our country.
Well, I originally wrote a piece called Exporting Homophobia, The American Far-Right Conservative Church's Established Influence in the Anti-Gay Africa in 2009 for the Boise Weekly. And it was my first real investigative piece. And I did a lot of research on all of the individuals who were proselytizing over in Uganda that were sending out, you know, homophobic rhetoric. And, you know, when you start drawing the lines between all these organizations and people, it seems like a lot of it's all connected, and there's this big effort, even though some of these people don't really interrelate with each other. They all seem to work for the same effort. Mm-hmm. Writing that piece really opened my eyes, Reverend Mark Kimbia here, to do some fundraising. And that was a really interesting experience to talk to him about his experience as a minister, a Unitarian mm-hmm. minister in Uganda, and the people that he was helping try to stay safe. Now, those were in the days when they had the death penalty
yes.
clause in it, which yes. has now been removed. Recently, I've been in contact with a couple of my sources that have sort of, as a result of my interviews with them, have become friends. One is a doctor who came to the United States a couple years ago because he was being tortured to give up the names of his patients and refused to do so. And he's had quite a journey. Mm-hmm. He's now in San Francisco, thankfully, and he's mm-hmm. safe and trying to reestablish his life there. Another gentleman, Peter, who I wrote about in the piece, is still trying to make it out of the country there. It's very dire. I get contacted, you know, weekly of people who are looking for money. I've raised some money to help a couple of individuals. I wish it could be more, but you do what you can do. There's a lot of people with a lot of different efforts going on around the country, and I think it's essential.
Describe Idaho for our listeners.
Well, mostly Idaho is live and let live until you look at the disparity between religious liberty and civil rights. Up until a few years ago, I would say most of it's live and let live. I haven't experienced a lot of personal homophobia here, although I know many people who have. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was 10 years behind when I first moved here. Now, I would say the tide is starting to turn, but because we have such a stronghold in the state house, progressive legislation is really, you know, it's almost impossible to get anything through. So, You know, it's a mixed bag lately. I could give you a more definite answer a couple of years ago, but right now it feels like a mixed bag with the marriage ban that's been overturned, mm-hmm. with a lot of things that are happening nationally. I think Idaho is going to fall in line, but it's going to be one of the last ones probably, mm-hmm. if they have anything to say about it.
You get to spend a lot of time writing about things that aren't good. Where do you find hope?
I find hope in the truth. You know, truth floats. I mean, the truth always comes out. And for those individuals who are on the wrong side of history, my belief is exposing them for what they are, which a lot of time is really about prejudice and hate masked in politics. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us who do this work believe that. Otherwise, we wouldn't see some of the changes that we're seeing. And that gives me hope.
Yeah. So what do you do when you don't want to get up one morning?
There are mornings. There have been mornings where I have not gotten up. I think, you know, channeling that energy toward a positive end really helps with the anger and the frustration, because yeah. really that's where a lot of this comes from. Being cast as a second-class citizen most of your life and seeing injustice in other demographics is abhorrent to me. And mm-hmm. it's really hard to balance feeling that anger and turning that into a positive action yeah. for change.
Yeah. My sense is that many of our listeners do not understand what Idaho is like in terms of the size of the challenge and some of the bigotry that you have to encounter. And you're talking about it as I would expect you to do, just like you're functioning anywhere else, but you're not anywhere else.
No,
and this is tough territory in which to
work. This is the front lines. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where a lot of the activism work really matters in a way that it doesn't matter in the blue states or in the coastal states. There are people who live in rural Idaho here who are afraid to come out, who are afraid to balk with the status quo in any way because their lives are in danger. There's mm-hmm. a high rate of suicide. There's a lot of things that people encounter. For example, we had this wonderful overturning of the constitutional ban against gay marriage mm-hmm. in the state. And yet, if a person were to get married in this state legally, there are no employment, housing, or public accommodation protections. So if I were to legally get married, which I did in Seattle last year, a year and a half ago, if I were to legally get married in Idaho, I could lose my job mm-hmm. or somebody else could lose their kids or some other kind of right. That's one area where it's glaringly obvious that, mm-hmm. One movement is going in one direction. But for 8 years, we've been trying to get sexual orientation and gender identity added to the Idaho Human Rights Act. Mm-hmm. And for 8 years, the State Senate State Affairs Committee has, basically put on their earplugs.
So why do you stay here?
I've made my home here. I've raised my son here. My wife and I have a home and a community. And why should we have to leave, just to be able to be full citizens?
Jody Mae Chang is an independent journalist and activist living in Boise, Idaho. Jody, I thoroughly enjoyed our interview a few years ago. I'm glad you've given me a chance to turn the tables because you've got a story to tell yourself, and I really appreciate you sitting down with me today to do this interview.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's my honor.
Before we go, I guess it would be cynical to imply there's a profit motive to the religious rights attachment to the discredited ex-gay therapy movement. After all, the scam serves other strategic purposes. If all that's needed for someone with the same-sex orientation to, as they like to put it, walk out of the homosexual lifestyle is some pray away the gay sessions, then much of the human rights rhetoric that we've seen effectively used to promote LGBT rights becomes less powerful. The tactic isn't new. When you can't prove your opponent's wrong, muddy the waters as much as possible. Maybe the evidence of global climate change isn't conclusive yet. Maybe evolution isn't as scientifically sound as we've been led to believe. And maybe LGBT people can change if only they want to. Of course, this tactic requires an active effort to ignore hard evidence. How many conservative religious parents have lost years of relationship to LGBT sons and daughters because of the vain belief that change was both possible and desirable, and that acceptance would be destructive? How many such parents have lost children entirely thanks to this muddy cloud of false hope? How many ex-gay patients and therapists have disavowed the practice after devoting years to it? But the drumbeat of propaganda claiming that God demands a cure and offers a cure goes on and on and on and on. When California and New Jersey outlawed the snake oil practice for minors, the predictable cries of protest regarding religious liberty, freedom of speech, and blame for the next natural disaster could be heard from the far right. Just a few weeks ago, the Texas GOP enshrined an explicit endorsement of ex-gay therapy in its party platform. But earlier this month, a judge in New Jersey issued a ruling that may test the commitment of at least some proponents of this pseudoscience. In a lawsuit filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center, it looks like purveyors of conversion therapy may be found liable for the damage their so-called treatment caused to vulnerable patients, and even for the cost of later therapy to try to undo that damage. So let's see what this does to those who so eagerly promote Pray Away the Gay. If the hard evidence of damaged and destroyed human lives doesn't persuade them, maybe damage to their pocketbooks will. LGBT people of faith can't afford to be told they're not good enough in the eyes of God and that they've got to change who they love. Let's hope soon those who have been doing the telling won't be able to afford to do that either. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. I tell you all the time that listeners write us or call us across the country, and they tell us that they rely on what we do on this show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue that they simply can't find anywhere else. State of Belief is a program that needs your support because the nation needs the message that is pervasive in this show. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. Stay in touch with us all through the week on Facebook and Twitter. We have a listener line. The number is 202-681-4246. You can call us. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen also. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was. See what he was.